It's the Citing Canada edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, selling Canadian science, NASA sued by design, St. Patrick's Day deconstructed, and part two of our interview with Tony Sobrano on conspiracy theory as political ideology. Now let's begin episode 158. It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, Ethan, I heard about an interesting story this week. Actually, it's kind of a good bad thing. Apparently, Canadian research is the most cited work of any other country in the world, even though we only produce about one-tenth of the papers compared to the U.S. or U.K. We get high five to Canada. Woo-hoo!
Yeah, we're hitting above our weight class.
Yes. And I guess in an attempt to capitalize on this success, I'm going to give a positive spin here for a change. Recent moves by the Harper government is trying to shift the attention away from our researchers from what they call blue sky science. So that's like science into what's the weight of an atomic particle, or is the cosmos really expanding at the rate they think it is, to more business orientated, what they refer to, and I'm quoting the minister here, a concierge service for business. Now, this is largely done through the National Research Council, which is part of the Canadian government and supplies millions and millions of dollars each year to researchers. This has had some negative ramifications from research sciences themselves, because they think that if we go to the sort of more business model, that A, they won't be able to do the kind of research that will sort of advance humanity, and B, that the constraints of the business community will mean that if they find something interesting, they won't be able to follow it. The example that was used is the one researcher was doing some research into mice. And while he was doing it, he noticed these little bumps on the back of the mice. And he said, hey, what the heck are those? Shifted the entire direction of his research and was one of the discoverers of stem cells. He got a Nobel Prize for that. And under this sort of contract based to business, that would seem to be something they couldn't do. As well as, you know, why are we as a Canadian government, because this funds our Canadian money, you know, supporting business research when that should be sort of part of their thing. But the law is still new, so I won't jump on them yet. Like I say, I'll try and put a positive spin on this. But it's something that's interesting down the pike.
Well, I mean, it can be a good thing if this sort of innovation that we see in our scientific community leads to innovations among Canadian businesses that, improve our economy and improve other, you know, facets of our life. But as you say, we don't want to get to the position where our scientific research is got a sort of a bottom line to it that has to be met, so that those exciting anomalies that we detect will not be sort of, brushed under the carpet so that we can have, you know, a newer, faster iPad.
It's one of those things, too, that I saw they have an ad up for this sort of new shift that they're trying to move into. And there's this big difference between science and technology, and often we tend to get the two confused. Technology tends to be, like you say, the iPad. It's the neat little gadget that you get, but you don't get the neat little gadget until the science has been done beforehand. And, well, like I say, we will see where that goes in the future. But, Ethan, you were mentioning there are some other new things on the horizon.
Well, that's right. We've talked a lot in the past about the sort of beleaguered situation of CFI Canada. So I'm quite happy to report that the organization is moving forward and has recently elected a new board of directors. This is important for a couple of different reasons. One, it's CFI Canada is finally getting back to what it does best, which is promoting skepticism and critical thinking and secular humanism. But it's also a big step because this is the first time that CFI Canada has elected a board of directors. That's right. CFI Canada is taking its first steps towards becoming a democratic organization, which is a big win for us in the humanist community. The new board of directors includes three returning board members from the previous board, including Lauren Trottier, Kevin Smith, who is the new board chair, and Pat O'Brien. Joining them are new members, Gary Fitzgibbon, who is the vice chair of the board. He is an organizer of the One School System Network in Ontario, which speaks out against the privileged role religious schools have in Ontario. Joining him as well is Bizdad Ila, who is a MD with a PhD in neurology and neuroscience. Brian Elhart, who is the treasurer of the board. He works for a part-time as a coordinator for Science for Peace, an educational charity. He also serves on the board of the Canadian Secular Alliance. William Craner is also a new board member, and his background is film and production, so he'll be an asset for CFI's multimedia ventures. Also joining is Carly Cantine, who is the board secretary. She's been a volunteer with CFI Ottawa and the CAS, the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism. She comes from a background of marketing as well as law and society. And finally, Gary Bosley, who is the editor or was the editor of the magazine Humanist Perspectives, previously The Humanist in Canada. He was also the president of the Human Association of Canada as well. So the new board has a nice balance of science backgrounds, skepticism, critical thinking, as well as humanism, and a very good influx of people who have some new ideas and some new ways to take CFI in the future. It's, I think, a very promising advancement for the organization.
That sounds really good. So you say elected. Was this a broad election from all the member base?
No, this was an interesting election. The board was elected by the associate and advisors of CFI Canada. It wasn't a broad sort of anyone who has a member gets to vote, although in the future, CFI is looking at ways to sort of implement that. But like I said, it is a small step, but an important step from simply going to appointing board members from, you know, whatever qualifications they see fit at the time. This has actually given some of the, longtime volunteers and significant stakeholders in the organization the opportunity to choose from different candidates who should be on the board of directors. So not the step that we all want, but a step forward nonetheless.
Maybe to put this in a nice, good, positive spin, is that they are now electing board members. It's just a really small franchise. But like with all democracies, eventually the franchise will be expanded, perhaps every member who's part of CFI.
Oh, yeah. It kind of reminds me of Canada's road to democracy. At first it was it was democracy in quotation marks. But we eventually got the process a lot better, and I think that's the direction CFI is going as well. So I'm quite happy with that.
Speaking of going in a wrong direction, we're going to come back after this commercial. We're going to talk about NASA and intelligent design.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. You can also listen to the show by subscribing to iTunes. And I hope you enjoy your skeptical discussions and debate.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So, Don, NASA is in the news. And, it's in the news with intelligent design. What is going on here?
You know, it is so amazing how you can have, it's almost an oxymoron to say intelligent design and NASA in the same sentence. Apparently, a former employee, David Coffedge, lost his status as team leader after his co-workers complained of harassment and was eventually let go when the project ended itself. Of course, Coffedge was just one of 246 Jet Propulsion Lab employees who were terminated due to the budget cuts. CopRedge is active in intelligent design sphere and runs a website that interprets scientific discoveries through the lens of intelligent design. CopRedge was handing out to his co-workers video documentaries examining the, quote, scientific evidence for intelligent design produced by Illustra Media, where he's a board member. CopRedge's lawsuit asserts that he was not attempting to proselytize but that his attempts to share his beliefs with his fellow workers. To support the claim of suffering discrimination, he stated that when he expressed support for the anti-gay proposition in California and requested that the staff holiday party be relabeled Christmas party, he was labeled a Christian conservative. Quacks like a duck, walks like a duck. But he is getting support from the Discovery Institute, which is renowned for promoting and supporting the intelligent design argument. They see this as part of a pattern where basically there's a war on anyone who dissents from Darwin, and that we've seen this for several years. Copperidge originally brought suit in April 2010 after his demotion, alleging religious discrimination and harassment, and amended it after he lost his job to include wrongful termination. He's seeking damages, and a statement of his rights were violated. The National Center for Education and NASA expressed that they hope that this would be adjudicated as a simple employment action and not used as a backdoor way of arguing the scientific facts, like evolution. So, on the one hand, you know, if I sat there and I started bringing, hey, I'm an atheist and let me show you this to my friends, or some argument to work, and they said, listen, you're disrupting our environment, because not every work environment is going to be pro what I believe, should they have the right to fire me on this? I mean, I think there's more on this, but as that one argument, what do you think, Ethan?
Well, I think it's perhaps a difficult question, because the allegations are that he was harassing his coworkers, and that, I think, is a key phrase, because there's a certain, quite a bit of a difference from, say, you know, you or me going to one of our coworkers and say, hey, check out this cool TED Talk of Richard Dawkins, or take a look at this essay that was written by P.D. Myers, versus going up to someone and being, hey, listen, have you accepted Jesus Christ into your heart? One of them is a bit more invasive, and one of them is a bit more, well, for lack of a better word, it's inviting curiosity and discussion, and, you know, could actually lead to some pretty intense but, I think, fulfilling conversations. Now, it's hard to say, for example, whether Copage here was actually proselytizing or not. My personal opinion on that is if you're advocating for intelligent design, well, that's sort of a, you know, hand-wringing kind of way of saying that you are, in fact, proselytizing, as has been determined by the U.S. court system, that intelligent design is just religion wrapped up in a fancy package. So, I don't know, I can understand why he would be removed if his coworkers felt like he was going around proselytizing and making their work environment uncomfortable. So I think that here is the key. If anyone, whether they're religious or even an atheist, is going around making their workplace uncomfortable by raising these questions, and let's face it, it's not necessarily the most appropriate place for these questions either, you know, you could face job action, and I think that's what happened to this fellow here.
And I think it's a double-edged sword for him in the one sense, because he's kind of claiming that, you know, I'm being persecuted for my beliefs, but in a way, the fact that his beliefs have nothing to do with the workplace, the fact that he brought them up in the first place, means that you can interpret this as a form of proselytizing. Handing out videos about intelligent design, it seems to be that one extra step. And, I mean, to sit there and you needed to be in the room to know how much of an argument he put up saying, no, we can't have a holiday party, we need to have a Christmas party. The other thing I think that plays into this, and I think both of us are kind of agreed, NASA has really nothing to do with biology or evolution in most senses. So if he's involved designing rockets, his beliefs, even if they kind of bring a bit of disrepute to NASA in the science community, I don't think has as strong a case as some of the other topics we've covered in the past.
Well, yeah, exactly, because we've talked about situations like this where you have professors in universities who are perhaps either in biology or philosophy or wherever, bringing into the classroom or even just making it well known that they're creationists or what have you. And yeah, like, I mean, really, NASA, if he's working on jet propulsion, that's probably where his expertise are, and I'm sure NASA doesn't really care if he's an intelligent design proponent or a Christian or a Muslim or whatever. Really, what matters is can he do his job well? But of course, But it also it comes down to NASA has to make sure that they have the right work environment. And if this guy is bringing up topics that make his coworkers uncomfortable, that's going to, you know, affect their ability to do their job. So, well, I agree. Yeah, I mean, if he can make jets, you know, great. He's probably a great employee for NASA. But if he's causing a lot of conflict, then he's probably, probably causing more problems than he's actually worth.
And I think another thing that plays into this now, outside of the let's an employee issue, and was kind of mentioned by the National Science Foundation, was the idea that this may be another ploy by the intelligent design people to use the courts to promote their own agenda. If he does win and he somehow manages to word it that promotion of intelligent design is a First Amendment right, and that would somehow, like, that's a huge overreach, but that would be a big win for their side if they could somehow make this not about him being inappropriate or not in the workplace, but intelligent design is valid and should be protected by the law as a right. And that, I think they're worried that's going to become the argument, and why a number of people are worried about this more so than just NASA as a disgruntled employee.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, he was one of, what, 246 employees terminated last year? So, I mean, I think there's a certain level of, I can't say what's going on inside this guy's head, but I mean, you know, the Discovery Institute kind of has a history of sort of making mountains out of molehills when it comes to this sort of thing. I mean, seriously, are the other 246 employees who were terminated, do they not all have perhaps odd beliefs that, you know, given the right PR team can make it sound like NASA, you know, also happens to hate people who, you know, like blue jello? Like, I'm sure that these people all have their own interesting, beliefs and interests. And, you know, maybe he was terminated simply because, you know, they had to do budget cuts.
Yes. Although I think they all have the same beliefs. I've seen the movies. They're all clones by some evil scientist.
Evil intelligent design scientist.
Exactly. Speaking of evil and design, when we come back from the commercial, we're going to talk about St. Patrick's Day. Ah.
The 26th annual Brave New Playwrights Festival is almost here. Get stoked for comedies, tragedies, musicals, fairy tales, and dramas.
To be or not to be.
This year's festival includes over 30 actors, 12 plays, 12 directors, over a dozen designers, one stage reading, nearly 20 crew members, and 26 years of history under its belt. If that was too much math for you, just go to bravenew.ca for info and tickets. Brave New Playwrights, March 28th to April 1st.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So, a couple days ago, it was St. Patrick's Day. Now, I don't really understand a lot about St. Patrick's Day. I mean, I understand that it's an important day in Ireland's history, which for some reason is celebrated around the world with excessive amounts of alcoholic consumption and some pretty out-of-this-world stereotypes about the Irish that, frankly, are more offensive than anything. So I'm a little surprised that St. Patrick's Day is such a big, you know, holiday in what should be a very secular country. After all, this is basically a celebration of how Ireland was converted to Christianity. Now, I guess you could say, as an atheist, why would I celebrate St. Patrick's Day when that's the case? And to that I would say, well, that's right, I don't, because I don't think there's much to celebrate in the Christianization of Ireland. But what do you think, Don?
Well, you know, there's a lot of myths in that surrounds the whole St. Patrick's Day holiday. First of all, it's not really a holiday, right? It is a ceremony. It's a feast of St. Patrick's Day, which is, you're right, extremely in the Catholic tradition. But part of that is, how do I put this? St. Patrick's Day himself is not as important as you might think. He did bring Catholicism, well, he's credited with converting Ireland, although, to be fair, when he died, Ireland was far from a Catholic country. It took about 500 years after his death before it became truly a Catholic country. And even at that point, it was a simple political maneuver by one of the upstart sort of princes of the era to become king of Ireland that cemented St. Patrick's Monastery, the center of his ecclesiastic empire, to become the central church of Ireland at the time. In fact, most people believe that St. Patrick himself wasn't actually one person. He was actually two people. The one person sort of we know, central focus, and the other one being a guy named Palladius. Palladius sort of worked the south, while Patrick worked the north. And they did achieve a lot of success because they focused on things like monasteries and strong abbots, which gave them a lot of power. But what we know of today as St. Patrick's Day is actually more of an American celebration. It's actually kind of created by the Americans and other places where Irish people wanted to reconnect with their Irish heritage. As I mentioned sort of earlier, St. Patrick's Day in Ireland was actually kind of a somber, rather subdued ceremony observance, religious observance. But when it came into the Canadian North American venue, it was more of a celebration of all things Irish, and St. Patrick's just kind of the excuse for it. And again, I agree with you, Ethan, in the sense that I don't really feel comfortable celebrating a saint's day. But in so many ways, this is no longer about St. Patrick. St. Patrick has been sort of expropriated by the Irish people to celebrate their own culture, where if you called it Ireland Day, it would sort of have the same festiveness, even if it wouldn't have the same quite kind of ring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I mean, we talked about sort of the religious origins of many holidays in the past. And ultimately what it comes down to is not so much what those origins were. I mean, they are historically important, but ultimately what we do when we celebrate those holidays nowadays and what the sort of modern, take we have with it. But I think honestly, the biggest concern that perhaps we should really have with St. Patrick's Day is probably more to do with the kind of somewhat demeaning stereotypes that get trotted out every year about the Irish. Especially in, you know, places that aren't really all that Irish, like Canada and like America, where I'm sure in Ireland, the celebrations don't involve, some of the kind of trite stereotypes that we perhaps see here.
True, although I think you may underestimate the number of Irish that form both Canada and the United States. According to Stats Canada, actually, the Irish are the fourth largest ethnic group in Canada. So it is outlandish. And I think there is a way where you can, for example, I was about to make some jokes at the beginning of this episode about drunk Irish people, but that's one of those stereotypes that have been overused. And the idea that, you know, the Irish can be seen as among a number of disparaging things, which I won't mention because I'd be repeating a disparaging comment. But I mean, like the green, you know, Ireland sees itself as an Emerald Isle. It's very green. So that doesn't seem like so disparaging. I'm not sure if a leprechaun is a entirely disparaging symbolism, the shamrock, not so disparaging. What particular things do you think are outlandish?
Well, I don't know. I personally think that a lot of these sort of cultural images are not really taken with any kind of seriousness. They're sort of trotted out in kind of sort of a almost like an exotic way, like, look at how Irish we are. When I think that a lot of the sort of racism and a lot of the bigotry that people of Irish descent faced in North America is really kind of glossed over, while people, you know, sing Danny Boy and drink themselves silly with green beer, when, you know, there is sort of some pretty serious issues that Irish people faced in these, and, you know, Canada and the U.S., dealing with, racism and bigotry and being sort of shoved aside into some of the more, you know, poor quarters of cities. I don't know. To me, I think that there's certainly room for, you know, fun and celebration, but I think at the same time we, it's sort of like Cinco de Mayo in certain areas of the United States, where you have some of the most conservative people imaginable sporting sort of Mexican hats without really understanding anything about Cinco de Mayo, while at the same time praising that big electric fence that they're building. But again, that's sort of an overly pessimistic view of things, I suppose.
No, I think you have some point there. I mean, like things like, you know, we celebrate Columbus Day without any realization of what some of the impact was, and Cinco de Mayo is another great example. Perhaps the Irish are not quite there yet, it has been talked about in the recent American politics about JFK and how he had to make special dispensations that although he was an Irish Catholic, that would not play into his role as president, and that there was a very strong racism towards certain ethnic groups that we don't think of today. I think I've commented to you privately, and I think I said it on the show, the whole concept of racism has really, really changed over the last century and a half. I mean, there's always been color racism, but you go back 100 years ago, or not even that far, you know, where the Irish were seen as animals. They were all sorts of bad things, and you had the same thing with people of Ukrainian descent and Polish descent. I was just noting that actually in Canada, we always pride ourselves in being very, very peaceful, but the one political assassination we've ever had was against an Irish person. Coincidence? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question to debate, and I encourage our listeners to write us, email us, and tweet us. What are your thoughts on not only St. Patrick's Day, as well as sort of celebrating cultural heritage, but how liberally should we celebrate cultural heritage? We look forward to hearing from you. But we should go on to our interview today.
Yes, this week we're going to have Tony Sobrato talking about conspiracy theory as political ideology, something I bet Darcy McGee was thinking when he was assassinated. Tune in after this commercial.
Any UBC student knows that the year begins optimistically. In your arms tonight. But by the end of it, you're ready for a little... Any smart UBC student will therefore know that it's best to get your tickets early to the annual AMS Block Party, featuring Mother Mother, Masterpack, DJ Headspin, The Boom Booms, and more. Thursday, April 5th on the McInnes Field, your AMS brings you the fifth year of music, partying, and hopefully some sunshine. Early bird tickets available at the Outpost until March 9th, and general tickets available thereafter. For more info, search for the AMS Block Party on Facebook. The fifth annual AMS Block Party is proudly sponsored by CITR.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC Westside area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books, The Bike Kitchen, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Grill, Gumdrops, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Are you walking to class? Are you grabbing a coffee? Got lunch hour to kill? We invite you to fill the silence of your day with the sound of some live music. Music on the Mind? UBC's newest student concert initiative invites the School of Music out of the concert hall into the schoolyard. 10 concerts at 5 venues on one campus. Let's get music on the mind at UBC. For more information, visit ubcmusiconthemind.com. Sponsored by CITR Radio, Vancouver, BC.
Welcome, listeners, to part two of our three-part interview with Tony Sobrato. Tony is a research analyst and social scientist currently based in London, author of the soon-to-be-published book, Who Rules the World? An Analysis of Conspiracy Theory. He also contributes to the Huffington Post. Last week, we talked about a framework to analyze conspiracy theories. This week, we delve deeper into how conspiracy theory has become a political ideology. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Tony, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy, JFK, Pearl Harbor, they sort of have historical continents, as in it's happened sort of before, slightly different facts on the ground, but it's not unique. But the recent experience of birtherism in the United States strikes me as something that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. This is sort of a new flavor of the whole conspiracy theory. That for a conspiracy theory to take root, it must have fertile soil, so to speak, to grow in. What are the societal and cultural elements that are either enabling or suppressing conspiracy theories? Are these modern features or are they something that go back through history?
They're probably a mixture of both, but it's obviously kind of culturally dependent as well. So the United States specifically has a long historical culture of advocating conspiracy theories, and there's been a lot of work in this area done by historians. One of the leading experts is someone called Rob Goldberg, who's written a lot on the historical tradition of conspiracy theories and explanations in America. And this, obviously, America, since its founding day in independence, has obviously kind of been battled with outsiders, whether it's the French or the English. So there's always been a form of tribalism in America, in terms of this is us trying to protect our land and we're always being invaded by some sort of foreigners that basically want to usurp our power. And you kind of still see that today, and this obviously ties into different aspects of gun control and the militia, but this is a reason why the individuals feel the need to protect themselves from outsiders. And certain factions in American society have always proposed there's kind of some outsider conspiratorial explanation going on behind events in America. That's obviously independent of the American cultural context. For example, in Europe, where we obviously have an older historical tradition based on different forms of government, conspiracy theories are much less salient here because we've had other explanations, such as we were constantly at war over different European and world empires. But what one aspect that you see in terms of giving fertile soil to conspiracy theories is open and closed societies. Now, democratic societies largely, where obviously opinion, debate and free will was encouraged, you get a diversity of views and polarized interests. So in America, as in Europe, people can believe in conspiracy theories if that's what they want. At the same time, they don't have to believe in conspiracy theories. And obviously that's what happens. If you look at what happens in more closed and undemocratic societies, where certain aspects of phenomena are still attributed to either outside external agents or non-social scientific agents. And there's two examples going on right now at the moment. One of it is if you look at the uprising in Egypt, where there was the violence there about a fortnight ago at the local football match, where a few people died after a few fights. I don't know how much that made the news in Canada. But behind that, the journalists on the ground interviewing the locals, there was just a whole barrage of conspiracy theories, generally attributed to international governments such as the French, the UK and the Americans, that were involved in sending the planes out last year to Egypt. That was basically a stunt pulled by these international governments to basically divide the Egyptian society further. And also right now in Russia, where they're having the disputes with Vladimir Putin about the election, they're having the re-election this weekend, the opposing government parties, majoritively led by fascist groups, in terms of they're blaming this kind of social and economic upheaval on migrant workers. So what you're seeing here is Russia's a slightly more open society than Egypt is, but it's still not democratic in what we would say in conventional Western terms. And these closed societies still, where they haven't got to the issue in terms of democratic complexity, and there isn't that much complexity and diversity in society, first port of call is still some sort of conspiratorial agents behind this, because complex social and economic phenomena isn't understood or studied in the same way that it is in Western Europe or America. And here you still see these kind of phenomena attributed to external agents. So that's a kind of cultural and societal explanation behind what gives conspiracy theories their fruition. But there's also other research forms, say the area of social psychology, and there's a big experiment from 2002 by a great psychologist called Bruce Schneier, and he came up with a concept which is major event, major cause theory, and this kind of just is completely applicable to something like 9/11, where you have such a huge event that's so tragic and ill-fated. What must be behind this phenomenon in terms of social psychology must be an equally huge and great cause. And this is where we get an inside job from the government, or if you're in David Icke's camp, it was some kind of extraterrestrials. Because what these grand conspiracy theories do is that they give social phenomena a greater purpose and structure. Otherwise, without it, it would be just random one-off events. And that causes a kind of cognitive dissonance. So that's kind of the mind playing tricks on itself, in terms of this event is so huge that it couldn't just be 11 terrorists or 18 terrorists on a plane doing this. There must be a more structured cause to it. So that's kind of conspiracy theories from a cognitive angle and why they have saliency. And then from a historical perspective, as I was saying, obviously the United States has got its own tradition, but there's other massive details throughout history. So if you look at the original Illuminati, which was the Bavarian Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt, that was originally based on the freedom of society from the church. And obviously for its time and its context, this is a huge radical position to espouse. So what happens with these kind of social movements is that they become enmeshed in conspiracy theories themselves. So at one time, which was a radical social agenda, such as basically divorcing society from the church, becomes explained by its opponents as this must be the devil's chicanery, this must be a conspired plot from the Illuminati that they want to take over the world. And we saw this in the 20th century in America with obviously the Marxist movement and the socialist movement, where America between, say, the 1920s onwards, under certain supervision of J. Edgar Hoover and other CIA operatives that wanted to basically track down communists because it was such a radical position to espouse the liberal democratic American view, that these kind of radical social movements, whether it's the Illuminati or the Freemasons, they always, in their time, get enmeshed in conspiracy theories, and this spills on throughout history. And you see this as well, which was a common conspiracy theory, which is the world is controlled by a Jewish cabal, and hatred for the Jewish sect dates back many a century. So they always pop up in conspiracies themselves. So what makes conspiracy theories fertile is a mix of psychological cognitive appeal, obviously social, historical and cultural needs. And this is kind of the area that makes it fertile. Now, the birtherism, as you originally stated, that is a classic case of just American paranoia in itself. And I agree that it wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. And the reason that it has come to light is because general mistrust in the government has increased over the last 2 years. We've got, as I mentioned earlier, postmodernism used as an explanation in terms of any discourse is up for grabs. And this kind of post 9/11 kind of syndrome, and where nothing is taken at face value anymore, and to the extent that it's also a political agenda that obviously the rivals of Obama need some kind of gravity or levitas to throw at him to basically discredit him. And lo and behold, we have a conspiracy theory arising, so trivial as well, that the guy may not have been born on US soil. So there are different reasons why conspiracy theories emerge, but that's one aspect of why the birther issue emerged. It's kind of a mix of cultural values and historical values as well, where people have seen throughout history that there are certain groups that get blamed for certain events, and we see this still quite salient in the modern world. And the birtherism is just one of the latest examples. The same with Egypt blaming the outside world for some of their social problems at the moment.
Okay, we're going to take a bit of a break. When we come back, we'll continue our interview with Tony Sobrato.
This is Phil Plate of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Welcome back. So, Tony, one thing that's often sort of thrown around in this area is the increased complexity of society. That, you know, if you go back 200 years ago, most people were farmers. They knew how to build their own homes. That, you know, there was a much more deeper understanding of most everyday thing. But now we're surrounded with all this technology, with everything that's built in my home. I had no idea how any of this stuff was built. I have a vague understanding how the electronics works. But does that reinforce this idea that there are forces around me constantly that are operating to do things that I don't understand, and that can be sort of blown up into the macro, that if it can happen in my home, why can't it happen in society at large?
Yes, I mean, to a certain extent, that's true. The complexity syndrome can work both ways. You can either use it as an argument for the kind of conspiratorial schema that we see operating today in the 21st century, which is things are so complex. I don't know the full physics of how they get rockets into outer space, but I know they do somehow or another. So if there's agents capable of doing that, who knows what else they're capable of doing? I mean, if you take that, as you say, to a starting point, that is permissible. But if you take that to its logical conclusion, then at the same time, just because something is unknowable in this present day or it has certain mystique doesn't mean that there's a conspiracy theory behind it. And obviously conspiracy theories, a large part of the time, are just basically theories of the gaps where we don't have knowledge right now. To fill in these gaps, we basically invent a conspiracy theory to basically account for it. At the same time, on the other hand, this kind of social complexity that we see kind of debunks conspiracy theories on the same hand, in terms of if we see how complex phenomena are, even now in the suburbs of, global cities where things are at the same time independent yet dependent from one another. If you think of what goes on in terms of social interaction and chains of commerce in your local suburbs, they're complex enough that, I mean, we aren't living in like centuries ago where people, certain militia and mobs could control towns. We don't have that anymore. So if you think of how complex your local suburban area is, let alone a massive city, let alone a country, a continent or a world, then you have to really start to think about how an agency or a group could actually control all the facets of all these complex global interactions. And as I mentioned earlier, this is the era where you get evolutionary conspiracy theories, where it's no longer in the social realm, but it's kind of outside in the metaphysical realm, whether it's aliens, shape-shifting consciousness, or forms of satanic explanation. So to a certain extent, I think complexity can be used in espousing a conspiracy theory, but largely it's kind of used to discredit it, because personally I believe the more likely explanation is that you can't control this complex phenomena. And on the other hand, even though we have complex phenomena that we ourselves don't know necessarily how they operate, this kind of mystique and enigma doesn't necessarily qualify for using conspiracy theory as a form of rational explanation. But as you were saying, I'm sure this is one psychological motivating factor why people do use this conspiracy theory in terms of what is it that's driving this complexity.
So we spent some time discussing, you know, a theory about conspiracy theory. How does this fit into the pantheon of philosophical thought, or is a branch of social science?
Well, it's a mixture of both in terms of, obviously, philosophically, we're dealing with aspects of ontology and epistemology, so it's forms of social reality and forms of social knowledge, how we painting pictures of reality and how we learn in where we get in our knowledge from in social reality. So one view that I've just expounded in an ontological way is that the world is full of social complexity, and it's hard for any kind of particular group to control this complexity, especially from, say, behind closed doors and in the direction they want. At the same time, epistemologically, it has to do with where is it that people are getting this knowledge from. One way is that they're literally inventing this, these theories in their discourses themselves, and that's obviously to do with the postmodern aspect. And another aspect in terms of philosophical epistemology is that people are using arcane and dogmatic canons to justify conspiratorial explanations. So if you look at stuff like the New World Order and the Illuminati, this stuff goes back centuries, and it's basically written in books by paranoid conspiracy theorists or people that wanted to bring down, say, the Illuminati of its day. And they've written a book 300 years ago. A famous one is a book by John Robinson, which basically accused the Illuminati of world domination. And 300 years on, people are still using these kind of books as forms of justification and knowledge, as if they're valid and valid at the same time. Also, if you look at metaphysical conspiracy theories, which you often see with conservative people, which think it's basically the devil's behind this, their source to knowledge is the Bible. So if you think of the epistemology where people are getting these theories and ideas from, then it's very important that it plays into the hands of philosophy, and this is in terms of epistemology and ontology. In terms of the social sciences, this is twofold. So the social sciences, A, can account for the phenomena that's apparently attributed to conspiracy theory, and you made the point very well earlier that if you look at how corporations operate, then you can use idioms from economics, free market economics, and Marxism to a certain extent, and even liberal democratic institutions in terms of these corporations are out to maximise profit to give to shareholders, and this is how society operates. So if you look at a social scientist or an economist going towards this phenomena, he'll be, or she'll be, basically stating that the corporations need to act like this because they work in a self-maximising rational paradigm that makes them need to fulfil their shareholders and make profits. That's using the social sciences to explain this phenomena that conspiracy theories instead say that this is how the phenomenon operates in terms of the conspiracy theory. So on the one hand, the social sciences are at the direct war with the conspiracy theories, because the conspiracy theories are saying, no, you can't use Marxism, you can't use free market economics, and you can't use any paradigms from the social sciences to explain this kind of phenomena, because we've got a theory for it, and it's basically that an elite group of people from around the world control the world and its complexities from behind closed doors. So that's one area where
a conspiracy theory is A, at war with the social sciences, but we can also use the social sciences to explore conspiracy theories, and you can do this across the spectrum. So using anthropology to see what it is in tribal communities that people espouse conspiracy theories in terms of agency, looking at social psychology, why people bound with other people that believe in the same ideas about them, and this is how conspiracy theories and their movements grow up, because one person reinforces another person's mental schema. And also, if you believe in one conspiracy theory, you're more likely to believe in another conspiracy theory. And that's research from the University of Virginia for about 2 years ago from a prominent psychologist there. So this is the kind of area where you can use the social sciences to explain and study conspiracy theory. And this is why I essentially treat conspiracy theory as just another form of social philosophy and as a form of political ideology in the social sciences.
So the idea of political ideology is something you've mentioned up before. So you're just saying essentially because they're rejecting, for lack of a better word, sort of classic political ideologies, this in itself becomes its own new political ideology.
In essence, yes, yes. So if you look at what can conspiracy theories advocated in terms of social and political phenomena, a Marxist explanation of corporate behavior isn't salient for them. Neither is an open and free society and accountable government and a separations of powers. That doesn't work for them either, because the people, A, in government are just puppet frontmen for a secret society, and these secret society operate and run the global political show. And what this does is, like all classic political paradigms, political paradigms espouse a view of social reality. So as the Marxist has the economic base driving political and social phenomena, the liberalist has inalienable individual rights that are ascribed to each person, and no one can transgress these rights, and thus we vote for government to rule over us, but only by our consent. And anarchists obviously have their own view of how society should operate, which is obviously small kind of tribal organizations kind of self-governing themselves without exterior interference from the state. What we have with meta-conspiracy theories, because here's where I make the separation with single-point conspiracy theories, because single-point conspiracy theories could be just attributed to single points of corruption, and this kind of activity does exist. But if you're a meta-conspiracy theorist, and you ascribe to 9/11 or JFK, then you're espousing a radical alternative for how social and political reality operates, because what you're saying is that what you observe in the news, the media, or what you even study in academia is really an illusion, and social reality isn't formed of this. It isn't, had nothing to do with an economic base. It has nothing to do with liberal individual rights from the government. It's basically the government and society has been deliberately created and is still maintained by some form of secret agency. So this is what makes it in itself an alternative political ideology, because they're, when obviously, as we've been discussing, they're standing in the face of people that live in democratic societies, and they're saying this is not how society or the government operates. We don't need this form of economics here. We don't need liberal government. Really, my political ideology is this, which is that the world is controlled and ruled by a certain sect. So in that respect, conspiracy theory is a form of political ideology, because it's used to explain social phenomena.
Interesting. Thanks, Tony. Next week, we'll have the final part of my interview with Tony Sobrato, where we discuss the intersection of conspiracy theory and conservatism, both here and in Europe. But now, a little break.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back. So this week we have some skeptic highlights. I've got two this week. One is a discussion, quote, "Is it wrong to wreck the world, climate change, and the moral obligation to the future?" Kathleen Dean Moore, co-founder of Spring Creek Project of Ideas, Nature and the Written Word, and professor of philosophy at Oregon State University,
will talk on the importance of viewing climate change as a moral crisis and taking a more moral responsive tone towards the issue. She will be talking at 7 p.m. March 21st at the Joseph and Rosalind Single Center, room 1400 at SFU Harbor Center. I don't think there's a cost for this, but more details will be on our show notes. On Friday, the 23rd of March, Seeing the Strings, Capitalism in You. This event will feature presentations by Igla Ivnova, researcher with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and Matthew Wildcat from the Department of Political Science at UBC. After a presentation, there will be a moment for discussion and workshops about capitalism and its effect. This will be again 7 p.m. this Friday at the Alma Van Duz and Peter Kay Room at the Downtown Vancouver Library. No cost for this. Ethan, do you have any highlights for this week?
Well, I have a highlight, but I mean, it's hardly a highlight. It's more of a look at what has happened.
A low light, maybe?
Perhaps a low light, yes. The University of Lethbridge has taken $2 million for a chair in complementary and alternative health care. So Dr. Tom Droog donated a lot of money to the U of Lethbridge to establish a professorship in complementary and alternative health care. According to the press release, the professorship will enable evidence-based research to explore the issue and take practices associated with complementary and alternative medicine. Now, of course, they would say that, but whether or not that will actually happen remains to be seen. It is sort of a trend that we've been noticing where alternative medicine is doing what it can to get itself within the walls of higher education. Now, this can be troubling for a couple of different reasons. One, it lends legitimacy to a science, or pseudoscience in this case, that simply has not earned legitimacy. It can also cloud the issue, I find. A lot of debates and discussions about these sort of things will often require citations. So people will cite university studies, or they will cite university courses, or they will look up course material and use that as research material. So when you search a university's webpage and you find this alternative medicine department on a university, perhaps the University of Lethbridge, that provides you with this, look, this must be legitimate. It's, you know, being studied at the university. And this can be very misleading, especially when it comes to things like people doing amateur research or even, you know, students doing research. Some of them haven't quite got their, detection kits working here and might be suckered in by, a study that really hasn't passed any kind of rigorous peer review being published on the university webpage. So I think this is perhaps an area of slight concern. But nevertheless, maybe there is that one slim chance that this actually could lead to some interesting developments. But at the very least, I think skeptics might be should be a little concerned about this infiltration.
I think actually I would both agree. Well, I'll agree with you twice because you came back at the end. Because you're right. I think this is definitely a ploy to gain authority by association or legitimacy by association. And that's definitely something we need to work on. But once it's in a university environment and it eventually is forced to adhere to the standards of the sciences, this may be one way to sort of hang it by its own rope. You know, give it enough rope and it'll eventually hang itself. And maybe this is one of the ways that they may actually end up doing more harm to their cause than good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll keep an eye on this particular skeptical lowlight for the future as well. Well, we're out of time here on Radio Freethinker. So please tune in next week where we'll have more skeptical interviews and, of course, more skepticism here on the show. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full. Measure elegant truth.